The Guardian.
Carol Birch is the author of 11 novels and has often been cited as a writer deserving of one of the big prizes. But it wasn't until Jamrach's Menagerie, her novel of 19th century adventuring and shipwreck, that she became a serious contender. It was longlisted for the All Women Orange Prize and shortlisted for the most prestigious of all, the Booker. She began by explaining who precisely her Jamrach was and why she gave the novel his name.
Well, he was a man who kept a menagerie in the East End of London, right by the docks where all the... near the tobacco dock where all the sort of brandy and tobacco and exotic spices and so on used to come in.
Which is now Wapping, isn't it?
It's Wapping, yes. And because, you know, his father had been there for years. His father had a business before he did, and then he took it over. And he was ideally situated so that the sailors coming in off the boats could bring in it. Curios from all over the world. And his father had been a major supplier of wild animals, and he took that over. And I think his son then took over after him. It was in the family.
But in a way, he's quite a marginal figure, isn't he?
It's in the book, yes.
In the book, he is.
Yes.
The main character is Jaffy.
Is Jaffy.
Yes, tell us about Jaffy.
Jaffy, well, I came across the story of Jamrach and the tiger and the little boy, which is a true story. That there was an escaped tiger that got out of its cage as it came off the docks and escaped and was walking down Ratcliffe Highway. And everybody, of course, ran away. And the story goes that this 8-year-old boy just walked up to it and stroked it on the nose. And I was taken by this somehow. I don't quite know why this lodged in my mind. And I started making up this fictional little boy and what it would be like for this little boy who's never come across anything like this. I think it must change you to be walking down the street in an ordinary place and suddenly meet a wild animal and be carried away with it. And I started making this story about Jaffy, and he just grew and grew and grew.
And there is, of course, a statue in the tobacco dock.
Yes, I didn't know about this when I started.
The little boy and the tiger, Jaffy and the tiger, is not the only real event in the book. There's also, of course, the shipwreck.
There's the shipwreck, yes. And that just came together quite fortuitously because I was writing the story about Jaffy anyway, this little boy, and I wasn't quite sure where I was going with it. And sometime around the same time, I read quite widely, and I just was reading about the whale ship Essex and the survivors' accounts, because fortunately, that's very, very well documented. The survivors left 3 or 4 accounts, and they were fascinating. They were absolutely fascinating, and it was such a very harrowing story, but at the same time, to me, I felt that there was this beautiful dimension in it somehow. I know it sounds weird to people, but the accounts that are left are very stark in a way. They're very impersonal. And I kept thinking, what was that like for those boys? You know, they were very young. They were very, very young boys. That was another thing that struck me. And the whole thing kind of came together with Jaffy.
And this was the a boat that inspired Herman Melville to write Moby Dick, wasn't it?
It's a very famous case. It was a really famous wreck. And the Essex was sunk by a whale.
But here again, it's only actually glancingly referred to, because the boat that Jaffy is on, he's sent off to pursue a wild animal, which we'll hear more about later.
Yes, that's completely fictional.
They just refer to it, and yet I'm very interested in the way that you use history.
I wanted them to refer to it because I didn't want people thinking that I was actually trying to write the Essex itself, but it was very much inspired by the Essex, which is also, the Essex has inspired other things as well, not just Melville, but there's a story by Edgar Allan Poe, and I think Jack London also did something.
Now, you've written novels about real people before, particularly Skate Gallows, wasn't it, which was about the horse thief, wasn't
Margaret Catchpole.
That's a rather reductive way to refer to the wonderful Margaret Catchpole, isn't it?
Yes.
So what is it with real people?
Well, I've only done it with those two books, actually, so it's just fairly recent, this, and historically as well. I mean, my historical books, it's only been the last three, really. Mm. Before that, I don't think I was confident enough to tackle history, but I realised at some stage that I could. You know, it was when I was doing Turn Again Home and I had to do the research of people fighting in the jungles of Malaya. I realised then that I could write about things that I hadn't actually experienced myself. And it was fascinating. So I then had the confidence to go on and write about history. Margaret just came along because I was on holiday in East Anglia, where she lived. And, you know, she's very well known down there, and came across her there and found her quite fascinating. And then I got hold of her letters home from Australia, which were in her own words and her own handwriting, and I sort of got her voice from that and just wanted to tell her story.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's go back to Jamrak. I'd like you to read a little bit. Okay. And the bit that I've asked you to read is about the discovery of what Jaffe and the shipmates think is a real live dragon. And the reason I wanted you to read this is because it struck me that what you do here is you're writing history from the inside out, as opposed to what I would call costume drama, writing history from the outside in. It's so evocative of what it must feel like to find something that's completely outside your experience.
The Malay with the tattoo held up his hand and everyone froze. How long we did not move, I don't know. Everything became very clear, every blade of grass. When I swallowed, my throat creaked. Dan motioned us cautiously forward with his hand without even looking back. We crept. And when we were gathered, sudden, so my heart jumped up like a man started from sleep by a bell. Bolt upright, stab. Then the hammering as of a demented woodpecker, a deer, leaping across the path ahead of us. One instant, a graceful prancing arc, and it was gone into the long grass. We stood staring and waiting. The silence roared. Then we followed the Malay's stalking feet, step by wary step, a distance of no more than a few yards before we stopped again, brought up short by a stink like a blocked privy. The grass sang. Something huge and dark came out of the scrub, 20 yards or so ahead of us, running very fast on 4 bow legs. It plunged into the high savannah in the direction the deer had gone. Time speeded up. We moved forward at a good pace, and all I knew was the high grasses on either side of me whispering at our passage, and the back of Dan's head, and my shoulders hurting, and my breath beginning to scrape a little. A good hour of it, till we slowed down and closed ranks again, close by the edge of some kind of rocky escarpment. There could be no more talking. We'd come so far now into the island that I'd lost all sense of scale and direction, and had no idea which way the ship was, or how far away. No idea whether the rock face to our right was the height of 2 tall men or as high as a mountain. The quick black shadow had scuttled before my eyes 1,000,000 times as we walked. How many more of those things were out there, hiding in the heavy brush, watching with hard reptilian eyes? I was never more afraid, but never so brightly aware. I felt as if my eyes were wide and overbright, and the others looked the same. Even the Malays, whom I'd considered knowing and unshakable and well-nigh invulnerable, all but shimmered with an unhinged energy. I'd faced the great whales, but they were known. And now a dumb show began. Our blood was up. We were in the wild, and the wild has teeth and claws and eyes and a stink like the rotting of a day-old carcass. I saw only a dark living bulk of great size, 4 bandy legs running. So fast, Dan and the Malays talked with their hands and shoulders and eyes. I wanted to be Dan. I wanted his gift for roaming the world, talking to everyone he met. I wanted his ease in outlandish places, and the way he never seemed afraid. I wanted the fear that moved in my belly to transmute into serenity. The smaller of the 2 Malays spotted blood. Something is leaving a trail. He moved his forearm in such a way, how he did it, I don't know. He made it look like a deer. Palm towards us, keeping us back, he went forward. For a while he stood absolutely motionless, looking through the thinning bush, then beckoned us cautiously on. We came like ghosts. I saw the deer first through the high grass. She was far away on the side of a long, balding slope, near dead, her blood trail following her faithfully, not quite to the shadow of the rock to which she'd dragged herself. She'd collapsed in the dust. A stain of blood widened about her, and she was trying, hopelessly but doggedly, to raise her head up sideways. Then I saw the dragon, just above and beyond us, completely still on a low wrinkle of land overlooking the plain. No more than a deck's length from me. A huge brownish-grey thing with black head and legs, bigger than a tiger, longer and lower, but raising its powerful chest and head as high at the front and trailing behind it a mighty weapon of a tail.
Oh, I love the way that Jaffe can only describe the monstrousness of it in terms of whales and tigers, things the seen. Things he's already seen.
Yes.
Was that a conscious decision on your part?
No. Well, when I write something like that, I try and imagine that I am, you know, in the little boy, really. And I don't consciously think, oh, you know, he'd see it like this or he'd see it like that. I just try and do it somehow. I write in quite a haphazard way, really. And when sometimes people say, oh, you did this and you did that. And I think, yes, I did, but I didn't necessarily do it consciously.
This presumably is a Komodo dragon, is it? What we
it
would
is.
Know as a Komodo
it is.
Dragon.
The Komodo dragon, well, they didn't know it in those days. I was surprised, actually, to find out myself that the Komodo dragon was only actually officially known about in the West in 1912, which is quite late.
And
before that, apparently, there were simply travellers' tales of this big dragon-like beast.
So Jamrach never did bring a Komodo dragon back to London?
Oh, no, not at all. This was completely fictional. You know, that's totally not true.
So, of course, they get onto the boat with the Komodo dragon. And this is when things begin to go terribly spooky, and because their superstition collides with this fear of the creature, doesn't it?
And also we have a boy on board who is a little bit unstable and slightly mystical in his way of thinking, who, you know, the boy Skip, who kind of whips things up a little bit, you know, with this sort of his strange fascination himself with the dragon, and sits and stares at it for hours on end and so on, talks to it. And he kind of, I think he's part of the whole problem, really, of why people start to kind of feel this superstition about the dragon, this kind of, because as soon as the dragon comes on board, bad luck starts.
Mm. Well, it's a bit like The Ancient Mariner, isn't it?
It is you a feel, little bit, yes, yeah. Yes.
And you, I just, you know, actually we know of how superstition can turn people's minds
and
in those
on ships
situations.
Particularly sailors were very prone to all kinds of sort of strange beliefs and
Now, a shipwreck story, which this is at its heart...
At its heart, yes.
...is a very populist form, isn't it? It's a very old and venerable populist form.
Absolutely.
Why did you choose this form?
I didn't really choose it. It chose me, I think. That's the answer to that one. I mean, I just became fascinated by those stories, and they came together, and I thought, I could really write this, rather than choosing it. In fact, it probably wasn't the greatest choice. I mean, when I mentioned it to a couple of people, they said, oh, no, you know, what a horrible story.
Because it's bad news, because it's...
Well, you know, because it does get... I mean, I don't know if I can mention what happens in case people don't know what happens, but, you know, it does get quite disturbing. And so some people just sort of saw it like that. And I always felt that I wanted to go beyond that. I didn't want it to be just a story about something grim. I wanted to point out that there was actually something quite beautiful about this story to me, which I hope is what came across in the book in the end. You know, I didn't want it to be just a gruesome story about what happened at sea. It was also quite transcendent to me in a way, and I thought about that when I thought of the people who'd survived these things. And I'm always fascinated when I do read about the things that people can survive and do survive and how they come through it and stay sane and live lives.
I'm reviewing The Return of Eliza Quinn in 2005 for Us, that's The Guardian. Okay. DJ Taylor said, nothing could be more literary than the fugitive lyricism of the prose, the delicate hint-strewing of the plot lines or the devious economy of the dialogue. Their subject matter, talking of your novels in the plural, on the other hand, comes straight out of the rows of buxom mass-market sagas that stack up on the supermarket shelf, all clogs, shawls, dense Mancunian fogs and the turbulent march of history.
It always makes me laugh because I suppose some of the forms I choose are ones which are very easily pigeonholed. And when I did, for example, Turn Again Home before that, I don't know how many times I read the phrase clogs and shawl. And I don't think there was a clog and shawl in that book at all. But because it was a family saga, it was about a family over 100 years in Manchester, everybody thought family saga, clogs, shawls, north. I'd like to take something that has that kind of, I suppose, hackneyed image, like a family saga or a shipwreck novel or whatever, and push it further than that and say, you know, this is actually a valid form.
It does give you a space. I mean, this seems to me this is the space you've claimed, you've reclaimed
sort
of populist tropes.
Again, I don't do it consciously. I just, something gets hold of me and I decide I'm going to do that because it wants to be written by me. That's the sounds a bit silly, but that's the way it feels.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.